Hello, welcome to the City of Charles Sturt's pod tour of Brompton. It's called Digging Up the Dirt, because that's what we're going to be doing. I'm Grant Cameron from 891 ABC Adelaide, and I'm your guide. We'll start our walk at Josiah Mitten Reserve, then we'll loop and meander through the streets of Brompton until we come to an end at the Excelsior Hotel. Now, this is going to take us about an hour and a half to do this tour at a fairly leisurely pace. We'll be covering close to 3.5 kilometres, so if you're concerned that it might be too far, I'd encourage you to think about taking the tour in stages. Whenever you feel the need, just put this player on pause, give yourself some time out for a breather and a drink and maybe a snack as well, and a chance to take in where you are and what you've seen so far. I should also point out that this tour features an optional detour past the Brompton School. That's going to add an extra kilometre to the journey, and if you have the time and the energy, I'd certainly recommend it. But if you don't, file it away for another day. I'll let you know when we get to that detour point. This walk has been developed in partnership with 891 ABC Adelaide, St Anna's Hostel, the Hindmarsh Historical Society, Bowden Brompton Community Centre and Hindmarsh Greening. Before we set out, can I quickly remind you to take care when you're walking. Now, some of the footpaths you'll be using are narrow and a bit uneven, especially on Hocking Street and West Street, which are a couple of the oldest in the area. And while I know that you'll become immersed in the stories and the history as we continue digging up the dirt, can I also ask that you at least keep half an ear tuned for cars and other traffic? We want this pod tour to be as safe as it will be enjoyable and memorable. Brompton has a colourful and fascinating history, with stories almost every step of the way. And as we wander and ponder, you'll hear some of the stories from the people who have, and still, call Brompton home. Brompton was laid out in 1840 as part of the town of Hindmarsh, and since then, it's enjoyed a series of popularity peaks and troughs. Brompton was once considered to be a slum. At one stage, it was littered with brick kilns and pockmarked with pug holes that produced the raw material. And now, you find modern housing estates and very desirable dwellings. Hopefully, you've downloaded the map that came with the pod tour on the City of Charles Sturt website. But if you haven't, fear not, you'll find a map on the walk brochure at the Hindmarsh Library on Port Road. Failing that, just listen carefully. I'll give you the directions you need to do the loop without getting lost. Okay, let's hit the trail and start digging up the dirt. First stop, Josiah Mitten Reserve. We get there from Wood Avenue, Hawker Street, or Burley Griffin Boulevard.
Stop 1. Josiah Mitten Reserve.
Brompton is built on brickyards in more ways than one. Backyard brickmaking enterprises started to appear not long after Brompton was laid out. And for more than a century, brick and pottery making was a key industry in this area, employing many of the local residents. At one point, there were close to 100 brickyards in Brompton, and the landscape became pockmarked with pug holes, the deep pits from which the clay was dug. This reserve was once a large pug hole. It stretched from Hawker Street, across this site to Coghlan Street, and it would have been 8 to 10 metres deep. As you can imagine, brickmaking was hard work, hot in summer and cold and wet in winter. The clay, or pug, was dug by hand. Brickmaking certainly not a job for the weak or faint-hearted. Early on, families worked their own blocks, digging the clay by hand, but mixing it with their bare feet. Bricks were hand-shaped in wooden moulds, stacked to dry, and then covered with wood for firing. And quality control was a bit of a hit-and-miss affair. In the 1870s, a building boom and the introduction of the brick kiln saw many of these family-run enterprises absorbed by the expanding larger yards. While horse and steam-powered machines began to be used during the brickmaking process, much of the work was still done by hand. The use of kilns produced a better quality product, but keeping the fire heat constant was a very demanding job. The men responsible for feeding those fires worked outside in all kinds of weather, most of the time bent over double, pushing wood into the ground-level small holes of the fireboxes. Even in the 1960s, ensuring that the bricks were fired correctly was a long and tiring process. Sometimes it would take one team 20 hours to get the job done, and they were not paid overtime. This work was a lifelong job. Many started straight from school as young lads of 13 or 14. Max Hammonds started work in a local pottery yard in 1940.
All I wanted to do was get out of school and work. I didn't like school. The only part I liked school was playing the sport, cricket or football or something like that. My dad had known for a while I wanted to get away from school. And Dad said, what are you going to do now? Are you going to go to work or are you going to go to school again? I said, no, don't want to go to school. said, right. He said, I'll see if I can get a job for you. So he only asked one of the chaps that lived around the area, any chance of a job at the Pottery's? So I'll find out, yeah, no worries. Went up there and started straight away. When you first started there, you used to only help out in the kills, help the men take little things or anything, small things you could carry into the kill so they could set it. And they burnt the kill after then. But you'd start off on that. Then if they thought you could do another job, they'd try and take you right through. Then they might put you on what we used to call junction sticking. You stick two pipes together, different angles and all that. Squares and OBs and all that, we used to call them, like that, for the sewage drains. Well, then, after that, if you went all right at that, you'd go to moulding. Anything you moulded by hand, well, you had to make them. And, well, that was interesting too. When you was moulding and all that, well, they'd mix the red clay they got from down the Pogo there. And they also brought in white clay from Golden Grove in those days. They used to have a pit up there. And they'd bring it down where they'd mix it together. Well, that was all right. But through winter, all your hands used to crack and all through, going through water and clay all the time. Oh, yeah. They used to get sore. But, no, she was all right. I don't know how anyone could grizzle, you know, in a job like that. There was a lot of hard work in that. I reckon the ones down the Pug Hole did, yes. But I only went down there one day. There was one chap missing, so they sent me down there. I wasn't too impressed with that. That was hard work. You had to pick and shovel and that. You had to pick the clay down off the bank, the side of the bank, say a wall. You had to pick it down and dig it all up and put it in this truck and then push the truck right back underneath to the sheds. And they had lifts from where I said about the tunnels. There's lifts going from there up to the shed, and they'd tip the truck up there and then bring it down and go out again. That's hard work. But a lot of them did it, mostly, when we were there, mostly the older men were out there that were doing that, been doing it for years.
And while the adults slaved away, digging the clay and making the bricks, the local children, even though their parents gave them strict orders not to go there, found the Pug Hole an adventurous and exciting place to play.
Oh, in those days, you used to go down the Pug Hole there because they had railway tracks down there for little trucks that had to come down to take the clay back to in the sheds and that. Well, sometimes they'd leave one of them out over the weekend, of course. Us kids would get down there and roll it up and down, push it up and down the track all the time there. Yeah, we used to do a lot of things down there. Used to go bird nesting down there, climb up the bank there. You used to have an old ladder or something, climb up the bank there and get the eggs out of the nest and everything for the birds. Yeah. Oh, then we had a swimming pool down. We used to call it a swimming pool. It was all covered with reeds around the outside with a border in the middle. And we used to get in there at different times and have a bit of a swim around. It was only about 6 foot square. It was only a small little place. But we used to get in there and have a good time in the water there. We used to have a bit of fun down there. Used to get down there at times and we'd have a little humpy we'd make down there. And we'd take a few eggs or something down and cook a few eggs in the humpy, you know, or potatoes and peel the potatoes and we'll throw them in the fire. Or, yeah. Yes. And the greengrocer around in Green Street, old Mr. Streets.
Oh, yeah.
He used to have his horses down there. And in those days, that's through winter and that, he used to have his horse trough and everything on one of the fences just wired up there. And when it rained through winter, we'd have a pool of water everywhere there. We'd go and undo the wire from the horse trough and put it down there and get a bit of a stick and make it, we were rowing around in the water. They come from everywhere, high emotional, you know, all around there. Used to have our fights and all down there too. Oh yeah, bricks and that, oh yeah. You'd just stand up at the top there, they'd be down the bottom or something, you'd be, oh yeah. Yeah, sometimes you hear them, sometimes you brick fights and all that, and then they'd have, some of them would have bows and arrows, or someone that might have a little bit of money, they'd come down with a slug gun. But everything was all right. No one ever got, really hurt there.
Stop two, the Burley Griffin Incinerator.
We find the Burley Griffin Incinerator on Burley Griffin Boulevard on the eastern side of Josiah Mitten Reserve. You can't miss it. See that large brick structure over there on the edge of the park? That's it. The 1930s Depression forced the closure of many of the brickyards, so what to do with all the abandoned punk holes? That became the pressing issue. For Hindmarsh Council and many of the local industries, they were a rubbish disposal opportunity, and the punk holes began to be filled with all kinds of rubbish, including the still smouldering rubble of a famous city department store that was destroyed by fire. The fumes from this hung over Brompton for months. Other items allegedly dumped in local pug holes included a bus and leftover ammunition from World War II. Roy and Ron remember the stench of burning pug hole rubbish.
One of them did go over about 6 months, yeah. And it smelled like when you fry onions and you fry them too much and they're sort of half burnt. It's a horrible smell. And we live not far from there. You too, Ron. You smell this horrible smell for about 6 months, day and night.
In 1935, as part of a relief scheme to provide work for the unemployed, construction of this Walter Burley Griffin-designed incinerator was started. It was built into the side of the pug hole, and you can still get an idea of this if you look at the incinerator from the park. Now, we all associate Walter Burley Griffin with the design of Canberra, but in the 1920s and 30s, he joined forces with another architect, Eric Nichols, to design a series of incinerators for local governments right across Australia. Burley Griffin believed in the aesthetic potential of industrial buildings and he used materials that related each building to its site, which you can see here in this incinerator through the use of bricks. As you can see, it doesn't particularly look like an incinerator, and no doubt this contributed to the rumours that the incinerator was a crematorium used for the disposing of bodies. Griffin and Nichols promoted their incinerators as efficient and hygienic, with less handling of unincinerated rubbish than any other methods. Trucks would drive up to the roller door on the top platform. They would tip their load into the garbage hopper. The rubbish was burnt as it moved down through the incinerator, and then it filled the punk hole below. This incinerator is now a Brompton icon, and it's truly significant because it's one of the few Burley Griffin-designed structures still standing in Australia. Our next stop is St Anna's Hostel. To get there, we follow Burley Griffin Boulevard to the south, passing Penn's Close on our right. The hostel is around the bend at number 41.
Stop 3, St Anna's Hostel.
St Anna's is one of the many aged care facilities that have brought new residents to Brompton, but also provided the older Bromptonites with the option to remain living in the community that they know and love. Fred McGuinness is a classic example. Fred grew up in Brompton, and before he came to St Anna's, he lived in a cottage built by his grandfather, and we'll visit that later on. St Anna's is very proud to be part of Brompton, and through its lifestyle program, it keeps residents connected to the area and its history.
With our lifestyle program, residents go for a walk around the area. And then we thought about, because also some of the residents who do go for the walks have got some degrees of dementia, that also finding something to spark off their memories and to talk about different things that happened in their childhood. Whereas this has been a very old area, and with all the new housing, some of them have got memories of what it used to be like before. So that's why we made an approach to the council to talk about a history walk so that we could actually capture things. And even though it may be the same walk that people go on continuously, it still will stir up memories within their memory bank from way back in childhood and different issues, especially when there was the pug holes and...
Because the residents know that this was a pug hole, so they make up stories about what's buried in this underneath us.
Oh, they think there could be bodies treasures,
everything, money, oh, lots of things like that. Lots of things.
We have a problem with the roses in the front garden because it obviously is where there's an old oil pit or whatever. And what has happened, especially with our dark roses, they have this dark centre part, which is obviously the roots have gone down to where the old oil pit is, and it's come up through the roses as well too.
Our next stop, the corner of Coghlan and Second Streets. To get there, we just continue along Burley Griffin Boulevard to Wood Avenue. At Wood Avenue, we turn left, and then at the next corner, we turn left again. That gets us to Second Street. On Second Street, we walk all the way to the end of the block, and that gets us to Coghlan Street. As we head towards Second Street, you might be thinking to yourself, where are all the historic buildings? Well, apart from the punk holes being redeveloped, Many of the older homes were knocked down in the 1960s to make way for a proposed freeway system across Adelaide. This was known as the Matts Plan. If it had gone ahead, it would have practically destroyed Brompton and neighbouring Bowden, because these two suburbs fell in the direct path of a north-south expressway corridor. The state government purchased many houses in preparation for this, and the inner west slid into a serious decline. Buildings were allowed to become run down, in some cases, totally uninhabitable. As you'd imagine, property values plummeted, the population fell, the community disintegrated, and people moved to wherever they could to find another home. In 1970, the Matts Plan was suspended and finally abandoned in 1983. But for all that time, Brompton just sat and stagnated. And it wasn't until the late 80s that the land created by this and the disused pug holes was seen as a development opportunity.
Stop 4. Coghlan Street.
Coghlan Street is named after Patrick Coghlan, the so-called King of Brompton Park, a former politician and a mayor of Hindmarsh. Coghlan was a pretty colourful character and well known for his wealth and the assumption of power which he felt that wealth entitled him to. He owned and subdivided this section of Brompton into very small blocks, which created very cramped living conditions. At one council meeting, it was suggested that Coghlan should be ashamed to sell people such small allotments. Coghlan interjected, "Ashamed of it? I'm ashamed of them not buying larger allotments." He was also described as being like a greyhound after a goose, in the way that he chased anyone who dared cross his land. No doubt, Coghlan's subdivision also contributed to the perception of Brompton being a slum. On these small blocks, substandard cottages were built to house workers who were desperate for cheap accommodation close to their employment. In winter, the area often flooded, and the floodwaters, combined with refuse, night soil and effluents from drains, turned the small yards into filthy patches of sodden earth. Now, we cross over Coghlan Street and keep walking along 2nd Avenue and turn right into Taylor Street.
Stop 5. Brompton Park Streets.
Life in Brompton's worker streets, like this one and neighbouring Pickering Street, was often a struggle, especially during times of unemployment such as the Depression. For women in particular, life was extremely hard. Many of them had large families, and caring for the children and doing the housework completely occupied their time and their minds. Of course, poverty would have excluded many of the women from the luxury of having their children born in a hospital. People who grew up in this part of town were aware that others regarded them as being poor. They, however, rarely thought of themselves as poor. Sure, things were tough, but they knew how to get by. They were a different type of people.
Oh, no, it was the type of people. Yeah.
I think what was, the people in the area were very poor, so it was the support that everybody was looked after one another, you with me?
Yeah.
Like, my mum was the eldest of 13 children, okay? They probably had 6 different houses or more, because, you know, a lot of times at midnight they were moving, because they hadn't paid their rent, so they were moving, so people looked after them, and, you know, especially with families that size. Pickering Street, for a start, and if you know the length of Pickering Street, was called Incubator Avenue, because there were so many kids there. They didn't think they could breed like that. They'd have to come out the incubator. You know, there was just kids everywhere. The people really cared for one another, you know.
Well, they were all in the same position,
yeah,
to a great extent. A lot of them had the same experiences, and they could sympathise with someone new in that experience. Yeah.
And if you know the size of them homes, you can just imagine having 13 children and mum and dad that's 15 beds they needed to find. I mean, fair enough, you know, the older ones might have been 20 or 30, some of them might have drifted away. Not saying they're all under the same roof at the same time, but they were still backwards and forwards, you know, like, and there was a lot of grandkids.
Now, we continue to walk along Taylor Street, and at the end of that, we turn left. This gets us to First Street. Fred McGuinness, who we met at St Anna's Hostel, used to live at number 12.
Stop 6. Fred's house.
This house was built by Fred McGuinness's grandfather. He came to Australia from Sweden and worked at the gasworks, which was located just down the end of this street. As one of 8 children, Fred's family was fairly typical of the area. It was large, was working class, and Fred's brother Max also lived in this house.
Well, there was 12 children my grandfather had and grandmother, so they lived in there. And there was 11 of us when we moved in. There was mum and father, 8 children, and my mother's sister lived with us. And I often think now, where'd we live? There was only really three bedrooms, plus the sleep out. And in the sleep out, there was Fred and myself, we was down one end, and two sisters were down the other end. It was very small inside, cramped. Mum always cooked on the wood stove. It was only in later years that when Fred went to the gasworks that he got a gas stove, but she always cooked on a wood stove. She was a very good cook. But I remember when I started on West Street and Hawker Street, it was Whitwell McCartney's. And that's where I started work there as apprentice cabinet maker. And I remember I used to bring the offcuts home in a bag on my bike for my mother, yeah, to burn in the stove. Whichever way the wind's blowing, you could smell the kills being burnt. Yeah. Mondays, my mother, she'd go out and look at the wind, because behind us was Worthley's, because the wind, she wouldn't wash, because you'd get that fine soot. Yeah. She always went which way the wind was blowing before she'd done her washing. Yeah. And she'd get really wild if she couldn't wash on Monday. But her washing was old wood copper, I can remember that, as you boil all the clothes. There was a big wooden mangle there, they'd put it through, all by hand, and iron. And actually, Mum's two sister, they lived in Second Street. And I always remember them, I think it was Tuesdays, the two of them would come down with the clothes to put through Mum's mangle. It was like rollers, wooden rollers. Oh, they worked hard.
Across the road from Fred's house is the MERS Housing Co-op. There are several housing cooperatives in this area, and this one is for artists. On the corner of First and Pickering Streets, we find the Brompton Hotel.
Stop 7, the Brompton Hotel.
This hotel opened in 1881 and soon became a venue for local activities, including concerts, court sessions, and public meetings. Local bootmaker John Jones was a regular customer, and in 1892, he was elected to a brief but certainly fiery stint as the Mayor of Hindmarsh, so the hotel became the site of many a rowdy council meeting. Mayor Jones' favourite topic was to complain about bloated capitalists, among which he counted his fellow councillors. In 1893, with Mayor Jones refusing to stand down, all of the councillors resigned, forcing another election to be held. In the 1990s, the hotel was still considered very much working class, despite the emerging rejuvenation of the suburb. At that time, it was popular for its scantily clad waitresses, who were protected from leering patrons by specially erected barriers. The Brompton is now an upmarket and very family-friendly hotel, and Dean, who's the manager, is more than happy for you to come in and have a good look around as part of your tour. It's now a state heritage place, and they're passionate about the history of this wonderful building. And if you come in through the car park, you can see some of the items that they've uncovered during the hotel's recent renovations.
We found a number of items. The bottles were quite extensive and we were really surprised with those. We had them cleaned up. So, yeah, we've displayed them in our entrance now. You can see them when you come into the hotel. That was the original part of the hotel, which is referred to as the lean-to, and that's where a lot of, well, where the kitchen was housed and where the cleaning and laundry facilities operated for the original part of the hotel. So no one really entered that, and it was a really terrible place of the hotel. So we actually made it the highlight. We reversed it. We lifted the roof off, and we encapsulated the fireplace, and we put a glass roof over it, and we made it a prominent part of the hotel. So people walk through there. So you go back 100 years, there were different things happening in that room than what they're happening today. A lot of sweat and tears, and there wasn't air conditioning back then, so it would have been pretty hot in there. Well, a couple of our patrons have come to us to let us know that, yes, they've heard stories of a female ghost, apparently we have. And that's why, if you look at our entrance, we have a painting of a lovely young lady, so we kind of think that that's probably part of the ghost situation. It's her reliving her life again in the hotel. It was a real working man's area, so the hotel, in its time, doesn't do it anymore, but in its time, the upper level of the hotel was used as a brothel. And so the gentleman of the day would finish work and come over and have a beer and be entertained by the ladies. So it had a pretty bad reputation for its time.
Now that you've finished at the hotel, we continue walking along First Street and we stop at the next corner on the left, which is West Street. From here, you can see that tall bluestone wall of the gasworks down on the end of First Street. The former Roman Catholic Church is on the corner of First and West Streets. The Brompton Gasworks first delivered gas to Adelaide in 1863. Along with the brickyards and other manufacturing industries, the gasworks was a major employer in the area, and during its heyday, there were several hundred workers on site. By today's standards, the production of gas in a suburb like Brompton, so close to the city, would be considered to be heavily polluting. But at its time, it was even seen as providing health benefits, because until the mid-1960s, gas was made by burning coal, and people used to be encouraged to bring their asthmatic children down to the gasworks and walk them around, because it was thought that the burning of coal cleared the air. How times have changed.
Stop 8. The former Roman Catholic Church of Our Most Holy Saviour.
The former Roman Catholic Church is on the corner of First and West Streets. It's now a private residence. The small chapel first opened in 1868 as a Sisters of St. Joseph's School. Under the guidance of their founder Mary MacKillop, the Josephites brought, and I quote, good Catholic instruction, unquote, to what they considered to be one of the poorest districts in South Australia. Before the chapel was built, the building from which the Josephites taught their 80 students was described as being literally worse than a stable. The inconveniences and squalid misery of this place would hardly be believed, said Father Woods, when fundraising for the chapel to be built.
Since my last report, the school at Bowden has been opened by the Sisters of St. Joseph. The district has been very much neglected, and the want of good Catholic instruction among the children was very evident. The nuns have been very successful so far. Their school numbers 80 children, among whom a great improvement is already noticeable. The school accommodation is, however, of the most wretched kind, situated in a most poor and dilapidated section of Bowden. It is to be hoped that the zeal and devotion of the ladies who consent to pursue their vocation there, amid poverty and its accompanying evils, will be borne in mind by the Catholics of the diocese, and some effort will be made to enable the nuns to do their duty at a cost of a little less personal suffering.
We turn into West Street and start heading north. Not very far along, on the left-hand side, is number 28. This is the childhood home of author Max Colwell, who, in his semi-autobiographical book Half Days and Patch Pants, wrote of life in Brompton during the 1930s as told through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy. The community that Colwell describes is full of characters bound together by poverty. Pug holes still dominate life, only many of them are abandoned and slowly filling with rubbish. They symbolise the unemployment and destitution of Brompton at that time.
Stop 9. Max Colwell's house.
Colwell's stories of mischief ring true with many who grew up in Brompton in the 30s and 40s, like the one about the day Fred and his mates made a slingshot by stretching a tyre tube between two iron spikes.
There was a hell of a chatter like a mob of skeletons dancing on a tin roof. Sidney looked at Fred. The stone had landed on his old man's roof. Fred was real mad. He said Sidney would be no good in a war, because he'd kill more friends than enemies.
And because of Max Colwell's book, this house has come to represent the difficult social and economic times of the Depression and the period between the wars. Now, further along West Street, opposite the corner of 2nd Street, is Thomas J. Smith's Premier Gym.
Stop 10. Thomas J. Smith's Premier Gym.
Larrikinism and the ability to find just a little bit of trouble is something of a badge of honour worn by many of the former childhood residents of Brompton. In response to that, the community has actively sought to provide services and entertainment to keep its youth on the straight and narrow. A former workers' hall for the social and educational advancement of workers, this old-style boxing gym continues a long tradition of instilling discipline into wayward youth. George was one of Thomas J. Smith's young protégés.
Thomas Smith was a boxing coach. He'd done it all his life. He used to live here in the gym. He was still living here to the age of 97. And he went to a nursing home and he passed away. And he was still running the gym. I'm one of the members that was coming in back then under him. I started and he would have been in his 80s when I started. I was about 15 years old. been here now 20, 30 years. Coaching now, after he passed away, we try to keep the gym going, and some of the older members like myself, they're coaches. Yeah, he coached in the army as well. He was in the army. He was very strict in the way he coached us. You weren't allowed to talk back or anything. He was also a physiotherapist, so whenever we had an injury, he used to fix us up pretty quick. But he used to live in it, and his whole life was boxing.
Now we keep wandering along West Street, passing 54 to 56 and 68 to 72 on our left.
Stop 11, numbers 54 to 56, West Street.
This section of West Street is significant for its cluster of worker housing. It was common for local employers, particularly brickmakers, to build houses for their workers. Rent was equal to one day's pay. These cottages were built in 1874 by the Hocking brothers, one of Brompton's most important industrial families. Their brickyard was located nearby.
Stop 12, numbers 68 to 72, West Street.
In 1877, the Hocking brothers extended their land, and soon afterwards they built this row of attached houses for their workers. The cottages are now owned by the Paris Flat Housing Cooperative as low-cost housing for community-minded people. The housing cooperatives in this area were some of the first in South Australia. They came about when local residents, such as Irene, joined together to fight against proposals such as the Mats Plan. And Brompton's strong tradition of social activism came to the fore at this time.
Well, that's the funny part about it. I've never really credited about being an activist. To me, that those homes needed to be saved to rent, because otherwise you'd be sent way out with housing trusts. And you'd wait ages anyway before you could get a house. And we said, well, all the conveniences, all the sewerage and electricity was all already in, so they didn't have to put it way out for us. We were content to pay that amount, you know. We paid $109,000 for a row of six cottages, in which I lived in one of them. And so we actually used to pay the bank. And it felt as though you were buying your own home. And, of course, at the same time, we were fighting to stop the Mats Plan. Of course, you understood that if you owned a house property, you had to maintain it, you had to pay the bills. And so between you, you agreed to do this and that, and this one would do this, and it now belongs to Housing SA. Now there's a central list that everybody can go on. The government do like to control things. It's nowhere near quite as volunteer as it used to be. It is once you get in, because you've got to run the co-op.
A short distance from numbers 68 to 72 is the intersection of West and 3rd Streets. The Brompton Uniting Church Hall, now a dance studio, is on the left. It fronts onto 3rd Street.
Stop 13, the Brompton Uniting Church Hall.
This hall was built by the Methodist Mission in 1909, and it's one of the few surviving mission buildings in the area. Mission work has a long tradition in Brompton, providing soup kitchens, clothing supplies, and relief work for the poor and unemployed. During the Depression, brick production fell, and families crammed together in their houses. Cash was in short supply, but that didn't mean an end to the fun and entertainment. Admission to social events was sometimes a pound of sugar, or even potatoes. The strong community spirit that's still part of Brompton today became even more important during these tough times. I reckon the Depression used to hold a lot of people together. We all used to help one another, and people would be friendly and lend each other things, said George Hanrahan of this period. He was retrenched and ended up being out of work for more than 2 years. As well as relying heavily on family and neighbours, self-sufficiency was required to get through those years of hardship.
As a kid, you go around door knocking, and you'd sell, say, two rabbits for sixpence. Okay, come home, got an order, off come the rabbit.
Yeah, I'm a little bit older than you. I used to sell, first rabbits I sold were threepence a pair. That's for the carcasses.
And then the skin yards used to be over there, you know where the chocolate place is, here on the river? That used to be the skin factory. I just could never believe that they had chocolates in there, and when you go in there as a kid, you couldn't even breathe. The stink was so bad. And they have rats. You could have rode these rats to school. They were the biggest rats you'd ever see.
We keep walking along West Street until we come to Hawker Street. That's the main road. Now, if you're feeling fit, you may wish to take the optional detour to see the historic Brompton School. Otherwise, you turn left at Hawker Street and keep walking until you come to the intersection of Green Street. You can listen to the story about the school as you walk.
Detour to Brompton School.
If you've chosen to take the detour, stay on West Street and cross over Hawker Street. The Brompton School is at the end of West Street on the corner of Torrens Road. You turn left onto Torrens Road to see the original school building. When this school was built in the late 1880s, not everyone was happy with the choice of location because it was an isolated site, the nearest house nearly a kilometre away. By 1906, the student population had reached 800. But an outbreak of diphtheria 3 years later led to accusations that the school had deteriorated to a filthy state. During the Depression, life in the school mirrored the hardships of home. Many students had no shoes, and in winter they'd sit there miserably in the frigid classroom, their feet blue from the cold. Those who did have shoes would stuff cardboard inside to cover the holes, as the soles were invariably worn out. By the mid-1970s, half of the student population was Greek, reflecting a cultural shift in the Brompton community. The school is now the Bowden Brompton Community School, a specialist high school. To return to the main walk, we continue west along Torrens Road. At the next corner, you turn left onto Wattle Street, and at the end of this street, you turn right. This is Fifth Street. Green Street runs to the left. We take Green Street to get back to Hawker Street.
Stop 14, Hawker Street.
Hawker Street is synonymous with Brompton. It was once the main artery of this group of suburbs, but by the 1980s, Hawker Street had fallen into such a neglected state it was considered to be the worst street in Adelaide. And prior to 1956, trams would run its length, carrying crowds to the Cheltenham races and the Croydon cinemas, and Brompton lads were known to willy on the rear of the tram to save the penny fare. Today, Hawker Street owes much of its creative appeal to the community action group Hindmarsh Greening. What started out as a desire to beautify the district has led to the creation of public art, mosaic pots, signs and stobie pole paintings that have become iconic to the inner west. Member Jill explains how the group went from greening to colouring.
The first things we used to do were to plant trees on any vacant land legally that we could find or add to the streetscape with street trees. We used to do those in winter to capture the winter rain. It got too hot to plant trees over summer, and we were actually gathering a lot of community support, and the community were very keen to be involved in activities when we weren't planting, so we branched out into community artwork. There's a pot that's on the corner of Hawker Street and Chief, which has the old gasometer on it, which one of the community members asked if we could have that in a pot in some form. It was part of the old South Australian Gas Works. And so now that big gasometer, which is quite a feature on the landscape, has now been, I guess, saved for posterity in a mosaic pot. And we also did the little workers' cottages as well. We also moved from the mosaic pots to painting stobie poles adjacent to the pots to theme. And then we started getting calls from people who said, oh, we want our stobie pole painted. So we'd encourage them to actually come and get the paint off us and work on a design and then do it themselves. And a couple of the posts we had to repaint because we'd used yellow, which got too confusing with some of the bus stops. You don't just want to see mosaic pots and stobie poles and community art everywhere, because it loses its distinctiveness. That's, I guess, why this area is so special.
Now we turn left into Green Street, or if you've completed the detour, you cross over Hawker Street. Not far along on the left is the Bowden Brompton Community Centre and Garden.
Stop 15, the Bowden Brompton Community Centre and Garden.
This centre was established by a community group that came together in 1972 as a self-help organisation for residents to address development, community and housing issues. Centre manager Isabel and centre user Helena believe that the reason why the centre is still such a hub after all these years is because it belongs to the community.
I think that's the key thing. I think there's an ownership of this place by people. I mean, people will come in and, you know, pull weeds out the front as they're walking in the door. There were a lot of isolated people who were living here, who came here, and now find it, it's part of their lives, and they've made friends within the community centre. They see each other outside of the community centre, that sort of thing.
Well, I think I've become a better person by coming here. It gives me a reason to get out of the house, and I come here and there are sort of courses here that I do. I'm much happier within myself because I'm using my own creativity as well. I can come in here during the day and mosaic a pot in the storeroom, and then I could pop in and see the resident artist Vicky and have a little chat to her. I feel as if I'm part of something, which is wonderful.
The neighbouring community garden began its life as the Hindmarsh City Farm in 1986. The idea for the garden was wonderful, but the implementation was woeful. In 1989, following complaints from the public about filth, rats, marijuana and misuse of funds, the garden was threatened with closure. It was saved by a group of passionate local residents. Today, the garden provides an important space for local green thumbs to have a veggie patch that their small backyards just don't allow. The patch closest to the street and just behind the park bench was planted by Stella and her family.
We planted strawberries, zucchini, cucumbers.
To be able to grow things that we love to eat, I think that's probably what sort of driven us.
Tomatoes, rocket, basil.
Sharing of seeds and just sharing of expertise and advice.
Spring onions and tomatoes.
Being in a sort of an inner suburb, you don't have a big yard, and that was one of the attractions. But it's also kind of frustrating because you don't have the vegetable patch that you get in a lot of those large sort of the old quarter acre block. So I guess it was very attractive, the idea that we could sort of come to a community based area and actually sort of meet the locals and grow our own produce.
From here we return to Hawker Street and turn left. A short distance away is Coghlan Street. The Excelsior Hotel is on the corner. We turn right into Coghlan Street and keep walking until we reach Fifth Street, which is the small street heading off to the left. If you follow Fifth Street, this takes you to a modern housing estate built on the site of the former Speedway. Now you'll need to follow Francis Ridley Circuit around to the left to reach a small park where the marker for the Rolly Park Speedway is located.
Stop 16. The Rolly Park Marker.
If Hawker Street was the artery of Brompton, then Rolly Park was its blood. For 30 years, from 1949, Rolly Park was Adelaide's favourite speedway. It was built in the hollow of an old pug hole, and Rolly Park provided entertainment at a time when there wasn't much else to do at night. Everyone goes to Rolly Park. That's what the advertising said, and on Friday nights, speedway nights, pretty much everybody did go. There were times when you couldn't drive a car from the Excelsior Hotel to the Rolly Park gates because of the crowds. The 1960s was the greatest era for Speedway. Fans would come in their thousands to watch the heroes from here, around Australia and around the world. Legends were made, including that of American Bob Two-Gun Tattersall. In a 50-lap derby, he lost his front left wheel very early in the race, but continued to pass car after car for 21 more laps before finally being eliminated. For those who lived in Brompton, the Speedway produced mixed feelings. There was the noise, there was the dust, and the inspired fashion in which the fans drove their vehicles through the streets after the Speedway finished. But others made the most of the attraction, and those who were close enough to the Speedway put small grandstands in their backyards.
Very tightly bunched as they come around that bottom corner for the start of the Australian 20-lap Speed Car Championship. It looks like a certain start, very good line indeed, and they come down here, Roy makes a very fast move around the outside, goes right around those cars, right out of high on the fence. And as they travel into the first corner, Brewer's right up there in third place. But out in the lead is Peter DeMack. Peter DeMack goes down that back straight really fast indeed. And behind him is Huppert. Then is Satan Brewer. Behind Satan Brewer is Arnie Sundstrom going very well. Then comes Cooper, Joe Blow out wide, Harry Neal, Rick Harvey, Rear's Hill, Keith Oliver.
As you stand here now, it's perhaps hard to imagine the sound of the roar of the engines and the enthusiasm of the crowd. We head north now through the park and along a landscaped walkway between the houses to John Hindmarsh Place, where the estate meets Torrens Road. We turn right onto Torrens Road and then take the next right back into Coghlan Street. On our right, the cottage homes at number 146.
Stop 17. Cottage homes.
If you are really tall, or if you stand on your tippy toes, or perhaps move to the opposite footpath, you can see the top of these State Heritage listed cottages over the brush fence. They were built to provide care for the aged and infirmed, and Cottage Homes Incorporated managed and ran the homes from 1890 until 1965 when they were sold. The 7 two-roomed cottages were initially occupied by 10 elderly women. Now we continue along Coghlan Street, back to Hawker Street and the Excelsior Hotel on the corner. This is our final stop.
Stop 18. The Excelsior Hotel.
During the brickmaking years, Brompton's social life revolved around the church and the pub. In the local pubs, brickyard workers were seen to be quenching their thirst created by the drying effects of the kiln heat and the clay. And while some went to the pub every day, payday was obviously the most popular. And men were seen to be securing an amount of money either in their shirt tails or in a handkerchief pinned to their chest just to make sure there was still some pay to take home to their families at the end of a big session. The Excelsior is now known as the Phantom Pub, but once it was famous for its sporting teams and a bookmaker, as Jim remembers.
Well, we used to have an SP bookmaker, like, well, I think every pub them days had them. Yeah. When I first started, well, that was just before decimal currency, and that was, what, 66, wasn't it? You know, with the old Rowley Park going, you know, like, used to get a mob there Friday night, you know. And used to have the picnics, like, you know, all-day picnic, and I'd leave me about 9 in the morning, I suppose, and get up there and, you know, like National Park or wherever, you know, which, well, you don't go there all the time, you go different places, you know. Like, yeah, we used to play the Gasworks and a couple of hotels on the port. We used to play against them in the cricket, you know. Probably harsh kickers on them, but and drunk, but yeah. In the real old days, like before I came here, they used to have a football team, Excelsiors, and they used to change in the little lounge, but it used to be little lounge, or just hard to tell nowadays, but used to come in there, sort of. Anyhow, they'd get dressed there, and they'd run down over Torrens Road to the Oval and play footy. Then when the footy was finished, they'd run back here and change it back into the civvy clothes.
Now, you may choose to finish your pod tour here. If not, you can choose to turn right into Hawker Street and head back to Josiah Mitten Reserve. Not very far away, it's on your left. Just look for a large metal chain sculpture that signals the entrance to the reserve. If you're interested in knowing more, the Hindmarsh Historical Society Museum in the old fire station, that's at Hindmarsh Place, Hindmarsh, has many historical photos and lots of artefacts from Brompton. Thanks for coming with us and digging up the dirt on Brompton.